Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Are children today taking too many tests? American students in grades 3 through 10 spend an average of 25% of every school year either taking exams or preparing for them. Most teachers dislike giving standardized tests nearly as much as kids hate taking them. And some experts are doubtful that these state-mandated exams can provide fair or accurate assessments of how students, teachers, schools, or school districts are performing. Anya Kamenetz is lead digital education reporter for NPR. Her new book is called The Test, Why Our Schools Are Obsessed with Standardized Testing, But You Don't Have to Be. Anya, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
I have to say, if one fact will stick with me forever after reading this book, it's the amount of time these tests are taking up. How does test prep differ from regular instruction?
That's a really great question. If you ask teachers, they'll say, and studies have really reinforced this, that when teachers are focused on a test, they teach more quickly, they lecture more, they focus more on rote memorization, and they also focus their instruction differently. So where a teacher, you know, a really skilled teacher would like to differentiate their instruction and reach every student and engage them, get them to think, get them to ask questions, if you're pushing a school toward achieving a certain passing grade on a test, the teachers are naturally going to gravitate toward just those students that are right on the bubble, what they call it, right below passing. And so students who are way up on the high end or way down on the low end actually end up getting less attention in a test-focused classroom.
Is it not possible for students to do all right on a test if they haven't received this kind of special coaching?
Of course. I mean, you know, proficiency scores on tests are very tied to a whole range of things beyond teaching to the test. Primarily, actually, it's zip code and family income that these test scores are correlated with.
Do we know why some kids whose, you know, family income and zip codes are comparable, why some seem to be more adept at taking tests than others who are doing equally well in school?
Well, that's a really interesting question, and psychologists have been looking at it for a long time. And they found over the years that 25 to 40% of people experience test anxiety that's strong enough to depress their scores or their outcomes. And so the very fact that you're told that you're given this test it is enough to often depress people's ability to remember anything that they knew. And the way that psychologists think this works is as you start doing the test, people are bothered by anxiety and by intrusive thoughts about how they're going to fail and the consequences. And that really distracts you from doing your best.
You had at least one child tell you in the course of your reporting that the tests are just boring. Like the idea is that they have to take them, but they're not really engaged in what they're doing.
Oh, I mean, I had a lot of students tell me that, actually. I visited schools all over the country, and this was a reaction of one sixth grader who basically said, yeah, I mean, it's not as fun as regular class because you're sitting there, you have to be quiet. It's really hard on kids that have attention issues or any kind of physical issues where, you know, just sitting still for that number of hours can take a toll. You know, but alongside the kids that are bored by the test, you have a lot that are really made unhappy by them. And a lot of parents that I spoke to, especially those that got involved in test-based activism, it was because their children didn't want to come to school anymore. They were crying, they were begging, and it was a serious toll that was taking on their quality of family life.
What do teachers identify as the things they most dislike about all this testing?
Well, it depends who you ask. And there, of course, are teachers who find standardized tests useful. At the same time, I think fundamentally, if you're a professional in any field, part of what it means to be a professional is that your performance is measured by your peers as well as your whoever it is that you're working with, whether that be the public, a client, a patient. And so teachers, especially very seasoned and experienced teachers, fundamentally resent the idea that a test is coming in and that test's outcomes is something that they're going to be judged by, and also that the state is willing to believe a score on a test over the testimony of that teacher as to how the student is doing. When you look at student outcomes, you know, the teacher's observations don't matter as much as the test scores do.
Anya, what do standardized tests actually measure, and what, I mean, how much can they predict overall success?
Well, this is a really this is kind of the core of the whole thing, right? I mean, there's debates about testing. Do we have too much? Are the stakes too high? But I really took it back to the fundamental of, well, what are these tests? What good are they? And, you know, psychometrically validated and standardized tests are built to measure very specific increments of what used to be called aptitude or IQ. Now we call we say that they're measuring something called achievement, which is supposed to be a little bit different. But fundamentally, the idea is that it's your knowledge at a point in time, and that's presumed to be fixed. And the kinds of tests that we give in school today are really only looking at limited measures of analytic ability, of math knowledge, rote memorization, of and of reading knowledge and comprehension, and not much else. And there's a whole range of, obviously, things that we think schools really should be teaching that the tests don't look at all.
And there are also a lot of skills that students might bring to bear on their entire education that these tests don't sort of give them credit for.
Well, that's a really important point. I mean, you know, what determines your success in life and your outcomes in life is not just academics, even broadly based academics, GPA, those types of things. At least half of the picture of people's future success has to do with what you might call in an earlier time character traits, things like, you know, perseverance or grit or a positive attitude, hopefulness, engagement. And these are things that social scientists are increasingly interested in measuring and looking at as being fundamental to students really succeeding and not things that tests get at all.
The scary thing is somebody is probably out there trying to develop like a multiple choice test for grit.
Well, I talk about that in the book, and I say, you know, we're really, really interested in these qualities, but it doesn't mean that they can be measured in the same ways that other qualities can. And I actually talked to the guy you're talking about, a guy named Patrick Killinan at ETS, which is one of these testing companies, and he said, you know, the measurements for things like grit are much more multidimensional, and they have to do with people answering questions about, you know, how they would respond in a specific situation. And sometimes you actually have to ask their teachers. So there's a measurement that's an outcome measurement for graduate students, and you get teachers to fill out a profile on a student. And again, you're kind of bringing the human judgment element back into the process to measure these really complex qualities.
If so many people really hate the way these tests work in classrooms, why do they have such a stranglehold on the educational system in America?
Well, you know, when I've been going out to bookstores, I've been asking this question comes up again and again, and I usually respond by asking, you know, do you personally recall what you got on your SATs? And most people, you know, in a room, most people usually say yes. And the reason for that is I think that the idea that there's a number that's going to tell you something essential about your performance or your kid's performance is incredibly seductive and powerful. And on a national basis, we bought into this idea that we can have data-driven, objective decision-making around something as important as our education system. And we want those numbers. We need those numbers. And so whether or not the numbers actually are quality or tell us anything really important, we sort of gravitate towards them again and again, and we keep attaching consequences to them.
Hmm. How lucrative is the standardized test industry?
The standardized testing industry is a multi-billion dollar industry. It's highly concentrated in a few companies that have had a corner in the market for a long time. There's also a strong presence of nonprofits, like the aforementioned ETS, in the industry as well. And I would also note the Common Core Consortia, the PARC and Smarter Balanced, which are commissioned to create the new Common Core aligned state tests, and they were funded to the tune of $360 million on the federal level. But the real moolah is not in the tests themselves. It's in the preparation materials. It's in the extra tutoring that parents pay for and that school districts pay for. And it's in the diversion of resources on an educational system-wide level, whether that be, you know, trained teachers taking time out of their day to prep students, to administer the tests, to grade the tests, and all of the administrative and planning costs that go into that as well.
So maybe all of this stress, all of this money would be worth it if testing delivered information that was truly useful, right, about how schools and individual students are progressing, about what they could do better. But what mm-hmm. kinds of issues can skew the accuracy of results?
Well, there's just a really wide range of issues, but on a fundamental level, the problem is notable, you know, across the social sciences, it's been called Goodhart's Law or Campbell's Law. And the principle is when a measure becomes attached to outcomes, it ceases to be a good measure. And so when we attach so many consequences to these tests, we are incentivizing people at every level to game the test. And that's parents to try to get their kids a better score. It's kids when they can to cheat on the tests, especially at a competitive high school level. It is sadly teachers in some situations, school districts, and especially states. I mean, states have played games at a really high level for years with the cutoff scores in these tests and manipulated them for the benefit of political leaders, whether they want to make the test scores look good or make the test scores look bad. In either way, it makes the tests much less useful.
What would be the incentive to make the test scores look bad?
Well, if you, for example, Mayor Bloomberg, when he was running for, re-election or running for election the first time, sorry, and he wanted to cast aspersions on the school performance and use that to gain control of schools, to institute more charter schools, to take more power away from the city public schools. Test scores are used to do that in a lot of situations.
Talk about that book, A Nation at Risk, that came out some years ago and how it framed the changes in SAT scores over time and what those assessments actually left out.
Okay, so this is so fascinating, right? Anybody who has any conversance, I think, with education policy knows this phrase, a nation at risk. And this was, you know, unlike most white papers, lived beyond its issuance in 1983. And I had always assumed that it was a scholarly study, a report where they took an objective look at test scores trends and used them to, and then were horrified, of course, by what they found out and said that it was, an issue of national security and all these other things. But when I interviewed some of the original authors of A Nation at Risk, what I found instead was that they were totally convinced from the get-go that schools were in decline and that we needed a whole new approach to schools. And basically, Reagan's folks commissioned these people to write this paper proving what they thought they already knew. And the way that they did this was they looked at aggregate downward trends in the SATs. And they said, you know, the average SAT scores are going down between the 60s and the 80s. But what they didn't look at, and what a later report showed to be true, was that, in fact, if you broke them out demographically, SAT scores were steady or even slightly improving. Women were doing a little bit better. Hispanics were doing a little bit better. African Americans were doing about the same. Men were doing about the same. But more people of more different types, more different backgrounds, a more diverse group, and larger numbers of people were taking the SATs from one generation to the next. And so the aggregate trend was downward, even though each group is doing better. And that was what was hugely misreported as being this national crisis.
Yeah, it sort of turns the whole thing on its head when you find out that, in fact, what it means is that more people are interested in going to college. It's not simply the creme de la creme of every high school.
Well, and you'll find again and again in the history of sort of beating the drum about the failure of education or the decline of education, part of what people are nervous about or worried about is the fact that more people are having access to education and they are using it in different ways. They are maybe coming to it from different ways and they're doing different things with it. And so, right, when you talk about the decline in academic standards, you really have to ask, well, compared to what? Because it's only been since Brown versus Board of Education that we have even attempted to have, you know, equal access to education for all Americans. So, it's hard to really make the case that what we're seeing overall is constant decline.
Anya Kamenetz is here. She is lead digital education reporter for NPR and author of the new book, The Test, Why Our Schools Are Obsessed with Standardized Testing, But You Don't Have to Be. You can be part of the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, featuring the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are being accepted for the program, which begins January 20th at SMU in Plano, smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with NPR's lead digital education reporter, Anya Kamenetz. Her new book is called The Test, Why Our Schools Are Obsessed with Standardized Testing, But You Don't Have to Be. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think at kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. How did multiple choice formats win the day for standardized tests?
I mean, it really has to do with what was easily machine gradable, and that's with the technology of the 1950s. This was initially the famous number two pencil was a graphite pencil that was read with an electric sensor, and that's kind of how it happened. And machine grading hasn't gotten all that much more sophisticated in the years since then.
And the thing about multiple choice, I mean, on the one hand, it is, as you say, easy to grade and you can sort of standardize the answers. And yet there's not really a great way to measure creative thinking or true comprehension, is there?
No, there's almost no way to. And in fact, this was tested by one of the most intriguing research I turned up in the book was Robert Sternberg, who was an intelligence researcher at Yale for many, many years. And he worked for the College Board to create something called the Rainbow Assessment. And he attempted to create multiple choice measures of things like creativity and practical intelligence. But he found that in the end, multiple choice measures meant if you ask people a multiple choice question, you're really just testing their analytic ability, their ability to guess, to eliminate, and to pick. Ended up finding different kinds of questions that did measure those types of abilities. But he said you can't do it with multiple choice.
I was astonished to read that despite all the PhDs credited with developing these tests when new versions come out, the process of actually writing the questions gets outsourced to people making $15 an hour.
It really is kind of a travesty, isn't it?
I couldn't believe it.
Of course, these organizations are fronted by very distinguished research scientists, and I personally spoke with incredibly smart and educated folks at the top levels, but independent items, if you think about the demand for independent items, especially a few years back when every single state was administering a different version of the test, and remember, it has to be a different version every year because otherwise there's test security issues, it's thousands upon thousands of items. And they are, in fact, written by short-term and not very well-paid workers. And so are they graded. When there's essay questions on these tests, the people who grade those essays are rushing. They have 1 or 2 minutes to grade each essay so that they can get paid a decent hourly rate wage.
There's also the issue of the fact that these tests are timed, and some students who might in fact get to all the answers but read a little slower or process a little slower get penalized.
Absolutely. I mean, students with all kinds of ranges and variations of ability have issues taking tests, and that's why there's been successful equity arguments mounted in multiple places saying that they're unfair to people, whether they have, some kind of diagnosis or disability, or they're limited English proficiency, even if they're classified that way, or simply because of other kinds of learning differences or issues with anxiety with a particular topic, especially math.
Interesting question via email here from Brett in Louisville, who asks, are there any states that actually use standardized tests to help target the needs of students, teachers, and schools to help all interested parties succeed instead of a pass-fail mentality?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I mean, the accountability system is multifaceted. On the federal level, since No Child Left Behind in 2002, it's been very simple, and it has been, unfortunately, much more focused on sticks than carrots. And so the outcome of statewide accountability tests is used to restructure, reorganize schools, and then ultimately label them as failing, close them down, target them for different kinds of intervention. On the state level, and especially on the district level, you see a much wider range of uses of tests, whether that be for diagnostic purposes, for what's called formative assessment, which is, really giving students much more useful information and the short range that they and their teachers and their parents can use to improve instruction. But the downside of that, of course, is the more different purposes of tests you have, oftentimes you just get more tests. Mm-hmm. And so that's why you're seeing these studies that show that, the vast majority of standardized tests that students take are required by districts, not by states. And there's the, up to 113 between kindergarten and grade 12.
Why do standardized tests, why are they so likely, as you say, to punish diversity? What does that mean?
Well, you know, when I say the standardized tests punish diversity, I'm really referring to kind of a perverse outcome of No Child Left Behind. And this was a, you know, a policy that originated, obviously, in Texas. And the idea was laudable. You know, it was to get schools to report out the performance of minority groups that were traditionally disadvantaged. And that would be low-income students, African-Americans, Hispanics, English language learners, and those with disabilities. And so by reporting out each subgroup, you couldn't hide behind the average. A school had to show that they were trying to make gains for students that were traditionally behind. But what that also means is that if the more different types of student you have in your school, the more chances you have to fail accountability targets. And indeed, that's what ended up happening, that schools that were more diverse were targeted more often for closure or for turnaround.
I want to talk about test scoring. Is there science behind where the line is placed between passing and failing some of these end-of-year course tests?
This is a really fascinating issue. You know, No Child Left Behind decreed that all children should be proficient by 2014. Spoiler alert, did not happen. but they did not define, the law did not define what it meant to be proficient. And it left that up, ultimately, I thought, to the test makers. But when I talked to someone at McGraw-Hill, he said, no, we don't decide what proficient is. That's decided by a committee in the State Board of Education. And again, this is an example of how states can game the system by setting proficiency scores wherever and whenever they want to within reason. And so what you had was, you know, two different states could be giving the same test, but one could decide that a score of 40 points was proficient and the other could decide that 60 points was proficient. And so proficiency ends up being almost completely meaningless, and so does accountability then, if accountability is based on proficiency.
So do you have evidence that states are, in fact, just looking to look good rather than looking to improve overall educational outcomes?
Well, I think that, you know, governments are complicated and they act with lots of different motives at the same time. There's certainly been studies that showed that, you know, just as I just described, that different states have very different measurements and definitions of what proficient meant or what they were trying to get their students to do. But I think, you know, it's always kind of a let's say it's a debate or a give and take between the public and politicians and educators about what, you know, what exactly we're trying to do here. Are we just trying to get the accountability mavens of the federal government off our backs, or are we really trying to strive to improve every single child? And I think often it ends up somewhere in the middle.
All right, let's jump onto the phones here. Lots of people want to say something at 1-800-933-5372. We have Frank on the line now in DeSoto. Hi, Frank.
How are you? I haven't had a chance to read the book, but I certainly will. And let me just say, I think that your author, although it sounds very good, has underestimated both the impact of class and race in three ways. First, she went over very quickly the aptitude achievement issue. And the reason why that's important is that because many lay people, and by lay people, as a former graduate dean, I mean, I'm talking about people all the way up into academic departments, really think that the tests are testing aptitude or capability. That's the critical thing. They think it's testing a student's really innate ability to learn or to be successful after the first year, et cetera. When if she talked to ETS, which I was also on one of their, or the GRE board, they acknowledged this achievement. Now, achievement is what is learned. So therefore, class effects of tutoring, of Kaplan courses, or many types of courses, is really a class effect, not, and especially it's not an aptitude effect. And so that's why that zip code analogy should not be gone over very quickly. And then the final thing, I think she underestimates the importance of the profit motive. She really did point it out how it's the profit maximizing influences both the questioners, the number of the low pay of those given the questions, and the low pay of those of the grading. So let's really look at the system as it is. It's really a class effect. With the reason why it's gotten so much momentum is because folks with additional income and resources, and that's across racial lines, of course, have an advantage. But it is a racial impact there because race and class in this country are they're clear winners and they're clear losers.
Frank, thank you so much for your call. Is there anything there that you want to respond to, Anya?
Yeah, I want to thank Frank for giving me the opportunity to kind of return to this point, because I kind of discuss at length sort of the historical racist origins of psychometrics in the book, as well as how these gaps persist today. And what we call the achievement gap, I say, is really more of a tautology, because what we're in fact doing is describing a difference in access to resources such as high-quality education. And so the achievement gap that we measure over and over again, all it really says is that students at a disadvantage, at an average, are at a disadvantage. And of course, there's always outliers that manage to, overcome the odds, but it doesn't mean then that the odds don't exist. And in fact, one study that I cite showed that for students in North Carolina, family income explained 85% of the variation in test scores. And so you don't really need a test to tell you what these kids are dealing with as much as you might need, for example, a look at census data.
So what happens in schools where a significant percentage of students fail? Are they simply, are teachers getting extra help to help those students, or are they just automatically punished?
When No Child Left Behind was being debated, there were advocates of having a better system of carrots. And the idea would be, offering extra services to schools, the ability to, more professional development resources for teachers. And that happens in some times in some places. But given the, economic pressures, the financial crisis in 2008, schools really operated often under, a scarcity model. And what ended up happening was that thousands upon thousands of schools were targeted for closure over the last decade and a half. And that was one of the most common outcomes of this accountability testing. And then starting from 2009, of course, the test scores started to be incorporated more into teacher evaluations as well. And so and then teachers were feeling, personal effects from the outcomes of the tests.
We know that there are some stellar schools that perform well on these tests and by other measures as well in some low-income neighborhoods. But it seems like there are no failing schools in wealthy neighborhoods. There are not any that we hear about. Is that is that correct?
I haven't looked comprehensively at the data, so I couldn't give you a blanket statement, but it does seem very surprising and odd. There are underperformers. There are certainly in affluent areas schools that families may be very complacent about that turns out that they're below the norm. But it's true, and again, this returns to the idea that poverty is such a significant determining factor in students, whatever it is that we're measuring with these tests. That it kind of overshadows almost everything else.
But the tests, I suppose, allow us not to focus on poverty.
Well, that's a very interesting statement. I mean, it depends on where you're coming from. There's always been a countervailing tradition in American politics that says what we need to do when it comes to education is to redress the effects of inequality directly. And that goes back to Brown versus Board of Ed, desegregation, actually changing the makeup of schools and changing students' access to resources is what we need to focus on. But since No Child Left Behind, the prevailing policies have been focused on the opposite, which is the idea that somehow if you impose enough rigor and enough accountability, enough consequences on poor schools full of poor students, that you can teach them out of poverty and that you can use schools to somehow redress the effects of poverty without having to pay for it.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to John on the line now in Austin. Hi, John.
Hi. Couple of things. First is my older brother and I both went to college. My older brother's PhD, bioorganic chemist, very much a good test taker. I'm just the opposite, terrible test taker. I never took the SAT, but I went to junior college, made my way through school, graduated. I work in the television business, totally different careers. And my worry about standardization is the fact that here we are. Did Steve Jobs do well on his SAT? Did Michael Dell? Did the great innovators that actually made a huge economic difference in this country, were they good so-called test takers? And I guess my main point is that when you try to standardize everything, how do you measure innovation? How do you measure the great people that come out and get out of the box? It was so great. Why haven't the Chinese, or stereotype, but the great innovations have come out of societies where free thinking has happened, And when you just try to standardize and put people in a box, it actually inhibits innovation.
What do you think, Anya?
I mean, I love that you're speaking to this issue, and I feel that there's a strong movement in schools of committed progressive educators and students and families who very much believe and understand that what we need to be cultivating is 21st century skills, communication, collaboration, innovation, empathy, the ability to deal with diversity in all its many forms. And, you know, I visit schools in the book that are working on integrations of assessment with the curriculum. And these are, you know, things like performance-based assessments where you have students doing these very high-level interdisciplinary performances, presentations, multimedia integrated things with different math and science at the same time. And they feel so electrified by it because they see that what they're doing is directly translatable into the types of careers that they would like to have. And it's not this artificial environment created by a standardized test.
Is anybody trying to break the mold? Anybody reliant on public funds for education?
Yes, they are. And in the second half of the book, I really talk about these kinds of movements forward. Montgomery County Public Schools in Maryland is a pretty diverse district where the superintendent is interested in integrating and has integrated in the school report card, in the internal self-evaluation process, things like measurements of student and faculty hope, engagement, and well-being. So these kind of squishy survey ideas actually end up being quite powerful when you aggregate them and look at them out over time. And he said, I have three kids in school. I'd like them to be straight A students and great people. And if I had to choose, I pick great people. And that's what he's trying to do in his school system.
Anya Kamenetz is here. She's lead digital education reporter for NPR and author of a new book called The Test, Why Our Schools Are Obsessed with Standardized Testing, But You Don't Have to Be. Join the conversation by emailing think@kera.org, sending a tweet to me at Chris Boyd Think, or calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, featuring the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are being accepted for the program, which begins January 20th at SMU in Plano, smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Anya Kamenetz, who is lead digital education reporter for NPR and author of The Test, Why Our Schools Are Obsessed with Standardized Testing, But You Don't Have to Be. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. Anya, a lot of what we've talked about so far has been maybe consequences that came along with good intentions and flawed execution. But you do detail in the book some really insidious effects of this, not least of which was the scandal in El Paso, in which students were essentially like invited to drop out of school if it appeared that they would not score well on their tests.
Yeah, this was a really ugly incident that was turned up that had to do with basically making school officials eligible for large cash bonuses in reaction or response to the test scores that they posted. And so in the El Paso Independent School District, you know, students, many of whom were recent immigrants from Mexico, were asked to leave school. Often they were misplaced in the wrong grades. They were asked or encouraged to drop out, get their GEDs. In some cases, truant officers would visit their homes and tell them not to come to school on test days. And the students that were pushed out of school this way, many of whom were, you know, low income, had really very little other recourse to get an education. They were known in locally as the desaparecidos, the disappeared ones.
Mm. Do grades matter at all anymore in school?
Well, yes, of course. I mean, you know, I think one of the important points to talk about when you're critiquing high-stakes standardized accountability testing is that testing in and of itself is part of great teaching and learning. Teachers give feedback, and they need to be able to give feedback and to get information about how their students are performing. And I think GPA grades can be really important. They're more important to the extent that they're meaningful to parents and to students and that they give them good information and timely information about how students are doing.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. George is on the line now in Dallas. Hey, George.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Good, good. I just wanted to make some comments. I am a teacher here in the Dallas area. I'm actually on my lunch break. And there are a few things that I've just listened to part of the show. I'm anxious to get the book. One thing is that special needs students that are low English proficiency, students with special needs and special disabilities, are still required to pass the standardized tests, even if it's a modified test. So a student that has a even maybe nonverbal, autistic, in some way have some disability, there's a lot of pressure on the school district to have a test that student can pass, even though maybe some of the most basic things that they do day in, day out are life skills related, not English, chemistry, science, social studies, those kind of things. The second point is that a school district has one hand tied behind their back in the sense that with so many transfer students coming in and out of school districts, the school district in which the student is tested is held responsible for the deficiencies of the school district that the student came from.
What do you know about all that, Anya?
I want to thank the educator for calling in and all the teachers that have helped me work on this book. There's actually a story about a student with special needs that I left out of the book because my editor thought it would be too distracting. But it is an outlier case, but it's a case of a student in Florida who had the intelligence of a six-month-old, multiple severe disabilities, very limited ability to indicate yes or no, and was forced by the fact that they were enrolled in a public home visit program. He wasn't even able to attend school, but forced to sit through hour upon hour of testing so that his public school teachers could get evaluated in order to keep their jobs. And this testing was incredibly stressful. It was stressful on the whole family, and it was a farce, as the mother said. And you do see many, many school students. You know, students with special needs have very individualized education plans. That's how federal, law is designed for them to have individual goals. And when they are subjected to standardized tests and outcomes, it often ends up wandering very, very far from the actual things that they need to focus on in order to, live the best lives that they can live.
There's kind of a little rogue section in the book for parents who want to get their kids out of taking these tests. What did you learn about that?
So this is really fascinating. Parents are opting out of tests, and in some cases, teachers are opting students out of tests, and children, young students on their own are opting out of tests. And basically what that means, it has yet to be tested in a final court of law, but, it's basically civil disobedience movement, and tens of thousands of students, by most reports across the country, opted out of spring 2014 tests. And in the book, I give step-by-step guidance for parents that decide that they want to sit their children out of one or more tests, and and how to get together with other parents to do it as well, because it really is a form of protest more than anything else.
What are the potential consequences for those children?
Well, in my reporting, and I'm still on top of this, but in my reporting, I did not turn up a situation where a student was kept back a grade or not allowed to apply to a high school because they didn't take a test. There are cases of petty intimidation. So you do have suspensions. You have students being threatened, being sent home. There was a case in Chicago of a young girl. Her classmates were rewarded with ice cream and candy, and she just had to sit there because she wasn't taking the test. So there's a lot of ways that schools are trying to get everyone to take these tests, but it doesn't mean that students have to do it.
Back to the phones now. This time we have Kevin on the line in Dallas. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, Chris. I wonder why we're not testing more toward what people are really interested in doing. For example, when I took the SAT, I got a whopping 970. and yet I was in my top 5% of my high school class. I went on to do an undergraduate and a master's degree and be on the dean's list every single semester I was in school. And then when I took the GRE to work on a doctoral program, I got the very same score on my GRE that I got on the SAT. And that's mainly because I'm not a math guy. And if you're not into geometry and whatnot, you don't do well on the SAT or the GRE because those are subjects I never took in school. So why aren't we addressing our tests if we have to take them toward what people are interested in? I'm a musician, and so, you know, math has little to no bearing on what I've made my career out of.
Absolutely. You know, in cases where we have more resources, and college admission might be an example of this, there's a lot of opportunity to do more nuanced kinds of testing. And not just, I mean, testing is one way of looking at it, but really assessments of interest-driven learning. Again, in sort of a performance assessment type school, you really have students, by the time they're in high school, gravitating very strongly toward the things that they're most passionate about. And the idea in a performance-based learning setting is that students should be able to show off the things that they're best at. And not always have to grind away at what they're worst at, because in fact, in our economy, our society, we want people to specialize. We want to have diverse talents, and shouldn't the education system cultivate that?
It's a hard question, though, because it's difficult to know with, you know, a ninth grader what kinds of skills he or she might need in adult life. And so to let that student make the decision, you know, maybe would be the wrong thing to do.
Well, I think I visited or spoke with people at the New York Performance Standards Consortium, which is a group of 28 very high-performing high schools that reflect the city's demographics, but they do teaching very differently. And I think the way that they look at it is you can cultivate higher-order skills, rigorous thinking and writing, research. They do have, you know, requirements as far as math and science goes, real inquiry-based science, so actually designing experiments and carrying them out. And you can cultivate all of those things, whether children are obsessed with Marx or baseball or avant-garde film or Disney movies. You know, it doesn't really matter what the topic is as long as you're very clear about the skills that you're trying to address.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Brent on the line in Grand Prairie. Hello, Brent.
Hey, good afternoon. Great conversation.
Thanks.
I wanted to express a slightly different point of view, something to think about. As an employer, but somebody also that didn't go and finish a formal education but went back later and attended college, I found that the skills at the basic level of the workforce were extremely lacking. And my question is, without testing, without some foundation, how do we assure that these people moving forward, these kids, are going to have the skills that employers need? And I was really concerned about it. They were lacking basic skills. Now, myself, I was able to go on and think outside the box and see what I needed in order to continue my career. But the majority of people, I feel you have to have something before you can choose to throw it away.
What do you think, Anya?
I mean, this is kind of the crux of the issue in a lot of ways, and it's the last ditch argument often made in favor of standards and accountability. And I guess the answer that I would have to it, you know, are you if you want to improve the quality of instruction and the way that schools work, it's a kind of a different question than if you just want to test in order to exclude people who come out of the system without the basic skills. And so, you know, are these tests really being used to improve the quality of instruction? The fact that our what they call the achievement gap has been very, very stubborn over the last, 15 years or so, I would argue, at the least, shows that testing alone is not going to do that. Testing may be a warning signal, and it may be able to, you know, show you that you, you know, there's something wrong with the car, but you can't drive by looking at the dashboard. You really have to look at the road. And so what we need is not just indicators and not just data, but we really need a comprehensive strategy to improve what's happening inside schools. And it's a much bigger problem than just tests.
Clearly, the people who got behind all this testing and grew this, the amount of time that schools are spending every year didn't set out to, you know, ruin everything and to work at cross purposes. Can you talk about, I mean, have you met educators who have really changed their views after seeing all of this in place and seeing it mushroom to the size that it is now?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the sort of test fatigue goes up to the highest level now. You've got President Obama recently speaking out about this and Arne Duncan as well, agreeing in a speech yesterday that we want to eliminate what he calls redundant and unnecessary testing. But the question is how that decision is going to be made. So on the state level, the Council of Chief State School Officers, the same folks who brought you the Common Core, are kind of saying we want to cut back on district level tests. And, these tests have kind of piled up on each other with no one person designing it. But it's a system that kind of became like, I call it like hangers multiplying in a closet, one test after another after another. So people across the board are agreeing here, and teachers and parents will tell you this too, that there are too many tests. But the problem is, as long as we have annual federal tests that are tied to accountability outcomes, then states and districts are going to want to give interim diagnostic benchmark tests to know how they're doing on the state tests. And that's, in fact, how these tests multiply.
They're not going anywhere anytime soon. What did you learn about how students can help themselves, how parents and teachers can help students?
Right. So the annual testing requirement is on the table right now, just to say. The No Child Left Behind is overdue for reauthorization. There's a lot of energy behind this in Congress this spring. So annual testing may not be as stuck with it as we think we are. At the same time, I give strategies in the book, and it's partly out of my own experience as a parent, knowing that whether it's the SAT or whether it's a kindergarten entrance exam, there's going to be tests along the way that I want my kid to take, and I want her to do really well on them. And so I give strategies that can help students in school, in tests, and also in life. And it's kind of a wide range of ideas.
So can you just give us a quick rundown of this?
Yeah. So I talk about demystifying the tests, knowing how they're put together, knowing that you're trying to beat the test makers, and it's like a game. I think there's a lot that students can learn by playing games. I talk about mindfulness. I talk about emotions and energy, sort of the holistic side of the picture when you look at school performance. Gets very mundane. Make sure you're sleeping enough, drinking enough water. I talk about parents and how parents can really bring concepts to life by hitting them in lots of different ways, lots of different contexts. And I spoke to a really excellent tutor who works with students who are autistic and have other learning differences and sees 20-point jumps on IQ tests with her techniques. And there's just a vast range in the book if you want to check it out.
Were you a good test taker in school?
I was decent. Yeah, I didn't have a lot of problems with it. I chafed at the restrictions and sort of the bureaucracy around testing. But, when I grew up in the 80s and 90s, annual tests hadn't made their debut, and I'm sure I'd have a much different school experience if they had.
Anya Kamenetz is lead digital education reporter for NPR. Her new book is called The Test, Why Our Schools Are Obsessed with Standardized Testing, But You Don't Have to Be. Anya, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Chris, thanks so much for the great questions.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.